Thank you so much, Trevor, for leading the service so far. And as Trevor indicated, we're going to be looking at Hebrews 2 and verses 5 to 10 this morning. Now, it was not to angels that God subjected the world of which to come of which we are speaking. It's been testified somewhere. What is man that you're mindful of him? Or the Son of Man, that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honour, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside of his control. At present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to him. But we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honour because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. Shortly before the Channel Tunnel was opened between France and England, the French president, François Mitterrand, made a rather sarcastic speech about the British. The French had already completed their fast route, their TGV Nord from Paris to Calais, and the Channel Tunnel was almost finished, and the TGV Nord allowed trains to travel through France at 186 miles per hour. The British were still arguing about the route that it should take from Dover to London and the cost. And so the trains coming through the Channel Tunnel then had to slow down and travel at much slower speeds on railways that had originally been designed by men with top hats and frock coats and mutton chop beards who stood for sepia photos with large cigars in their hands. And François Mitterrand said, "Next year we will set off at high speed across the northern plains of France. Then we shall push at speed into the Channel Tunnel, and then afterwards we will be able to dream at a very low speed in Britain and to admire the landscape." Well, last Sunday we sped through Hebrews chapter 1 at about 186 miles per hour. But this week, as we come up into chapter 2, I've decided that we need to slow right down so that we can admire the landscapes. One of the reasons that we went so quickly through last week is we took in seven Old Testament passages that the writer to Hebrews weaves in to demonstrate to his congregation that Jesus is superior to the angels. Was me reasoning to myself, but I don't think my congregation lie in bed at night wondering if, is Jesus really superior to the angels or not? I don't think you wake up in the small hours think, I'm really troubled about this, you know. Whereas clearly the original writers were troubled about this. Was Jesus superior to the angels? But having said that, it was still wonderful for me to have the deity of Jesus spelt out to me in chapter 1 in such a wonderful way. He is the Son. God says, let all the angels of God worship him. He is the Creator, verse 10. Verse 8, the Father calls him God. I can't wait for the Jehovah's Witnesses to turn up next time. Why won't you call him God when Hebrews 1, verse 8, God calls him God? And then the angels serve us. He saved us and then sat down. And we covered a lot of the Old Testament last time. But what the author keeps telling us to do in Hebrews is that we are to be considering Jesus. That's chapter 3, verse 1. And consider means look very closely at Jesus. And sometimes you have to slow down to do that. And he'll tell us later on in Hebrews that we are to run with endurance the race which is before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of our salvation. And for me, the race is often hard. And I'm no endurance runner. I need week by week to stop and to see Jesus. Or like Peter, who steps out of the boat in faith and walks through the storm towards Jesus, I find that my eyes drift off of Jesus and they get fixed on the storm and I begin to sink. So let's admire slowly as we come into chapter 2, not just the landscapes of Hebrews, but the portraits that the writer is giving to us as he shows us the Lord Jesus. And this is so relevant for us today. I mean, look at the things this text covers. You couldn't rush over this. It's about leadership and who's in control of everything. Is that not relevant? No, it is to me. I live in a country where there is a complete vacuum in leadership at the moment. And I worry that anyone would want to become leader of this omni-shambles that we go through at the moment. And then it's got that question, what is man? Well, that's really important, isn't it? What does it mean to be human? I hear a lot about human rights, but not a lot about what actually is it to be a human being. What are our roles? What are our responsibilities? And then also, as you look through the text, it's about the world to come. It's about the future. That's pretty relevant at the moment. But it's also about salvation. It's about hope. It's about God's last word that he's given to this world, that if we hear and believe, we can come and receive our true home. So I'm going to slow down, as I've said, as we get to chapter 2. The bad news for you is that means more sermons in this series. But the good news is that they're going to be shorter. Every cloud has a silver lining. And if there's one way you want to get Netley Christian Fellowship on side, it's to say the sermon is going to be shorter. Just 2 points this morning, both about the same length, though the first one's a little bit longer than the second, but we will be through in no time. The first is God's rule over the world. That's what this text is about. And just saying those words makes me profoundly thankful. This world does not run itself. It's not left in the hands of presidents and prime ministers and committees. God, the creator, has not abandoned his creation. He has a plan and he's done something. And we are first of all told what he's not done. Look at the text, verse 5. Now it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. Oh, perhaps to say something about what he means by the world to come. We might think exclusively as the new heavens and the new earth, the far off future, the climax of it all. And he certainly is looking to that, but he's thinking of more than just that. This man would have thought of the world in three stages. As God created it at the beginning, which is very good, and then as it is at the moment, cursed because of man's sin, under the shadow of death, ruined and broken, but also in the light of the promise that God has made to redeem this broken world and to restore all things. And he would do that through the coming of a new king. The climax of his work will be in the future, in the restoration of all things. But as he's told us, you're already living in the last days, beginning of chapter 1. And the coming of that king and his life and his death and his resurrection and ascension have brought in already the dawning of the kingdom of heaven. And he's already building a new family to inherit the earth at the end. Interestingly, Hebrews, when it talks about the world here, doesn't use the Greek word cosmos, which would be the fabric of creation. He uses a different word, oikomene, which the Greeks would have used for civilization, for ordered, structured, good, safe civilization. So the writer says he's not put the rule of all things at the moment and on into the future, the kingdom, into the hands of angels. Oh, well, sometimes I wish he had. I honestly do. I listen to the news and it's yesterday in Parliament. And I wish, couldn't he have just sent Gabriel to have bashed a few heads together? Sorted things out? Shouted at them, what on earth are you thinking about? What are you doing? But he hasn't committed the world to come into the hands of angels. And then the writer does something really remarkable. What are you expecting him to say at this point? Bearing in mind, every answer is always Jesus. You're thinking he's going to say he hasn't committed the world to come into the hands of angels, but clearly he has to Jesus. Well, he will eventually say that, but we've got to go at his speed. We've got to follow his argument. And he says, verse 6, it's been testified somewhere, like he doesn't know where or by who. I think he probably knew it was Psalm 8, and it was David around 1000 BC. And he says, what is man that you're mindful of him? Or the son of man that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honour, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, what was Psalm 8 all about? Jesus, you're getting ahead of yourself. When people read Psalm 8, 1000 BC, they didn't say, oh, it's about Jesus, isn't it? It's clearly about Jesus. They would have correctly said, this reminds me of Genesis chapter 1, creation. This is David giving us a poetic version of the narrative of Genesis 1. And it's a song about man as ruler over God's creation. Man and woman made uniquely in the image of God, with everything made subject to them, though for a little while he's lower than the angels in glory and rank. The implication is that he's to be lifted up past the angels and called sons and daughters of God, and to reign as God's kings and queens with him over the whole of creation. I imagine that people who sang that song for thousands of years, or 1,000 years after David wrote it, thought of it as being a slightly sad song. Because it looks back to what we've lost. It accurately picks up the themes of Genesis chapter 1, but people would have thought, that's not enough to say that, David. Didn't you read on? Didn't you read Genesis chapter 3 and the fall of man into sin and the curse coming down on us? So instead of this beautiful dominion rule over creation, this has become a battle for us. And it's by the toil of your hands and by the sweat of your brow that you wrestle with creation to cultivate it. You've been in the garden this week? Some of you have. And you're still feeling it, aren't you? And man who and woman who were created with all of this glory and this honor bestowed upon them now are told that they will return to the dust from which they were created, and the animals will walk on their dust, and the birds of the air will come and sit on their headstones. And all of the relationships that once were so harmonious and so beautiful now are fractured and out of joint, and suffering and strife fills the earth. Psalm 8 is a lovely bit of poetry, but it seems to be mocking us by reminding us of what we were and what we've lost. God gave it to man, and we messed it up. Well, it's true that a man utterly messed it up. But God had promised that a man would more than fix it. And his original plan, which was to put man and woman made in his image over his creation, was not going to be thwarted. He was determined that man, human beings, should reign with him in his creation as his sons and daughters. And Hebrews gets this. It wasn't to angels that he subjected not only the world in the past, but also the world to come. And suddenly we see that Psalm 8 is not a sad song about what we've lost. It's a prophetic song about what we will gain. And he doesn't change the verb tenses to past tenses. They're all still present tenses here. You have crowned him with glory and honour, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Not you did do this once and we lost it. You are doing this now. God's plan has not been thwarted. It's been realised. And man has gained the creation, glory and dominion that God promised. And then, having finished his quotation from Psalm 8, far from row back from this wonderful promise, he reinforces it and amplifies it. And he says, now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside of his control. This is good news. We've won. But you're thinking, I don't see this at the moment. Creation still creaks and groans. This is a world where there is still suffering and tears abounding. The cold shadow of death creeps over every day of our lives. There's a discordant noise of strife and war which still fills the earth. I just don't see it. Well, read on. Because Hebrews has already anticipated what you're thinking. And the writer says, at present we do not yet see everything subject to him, to mankind. The full vision of what is ours is not yet seen. The glory which is to be enjoyed is still ahead of us. But, he says, and this is where you're right, it's all about Jesus. But we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honour. To whom did God subject the world to come? A man. And in that man, all humanity who trusts in him. A man has won the victory and gained the throne. A second Adam has triumphed where the first Adam failed. And I love what Hebrews is doing here, because he spent all of chapter 1 showing you that Jesus is superior to the angels. Jesus is so much higher than the angels. Because he's the Son. Because the angels worship him. He is God. He's the Creator. And what has he said in chapter 2? That the one who is so much higher than the angels was for a little while made lower than the angels. He stooped down. He humbled himself to become man. He didn't stop being the Son. He didn't stop being God. But he fully took onto himself our humanity. As chapter 2 will go on, and we'll see in subsequent weeks, that he's not ashamed to be called your brother. Then he partook the same flesh and blood that you have. He has fully shared your humanity. At the end of the chapter, he's experienced your struggles and your temptations and your sufferings. And this man, Jesus Christ, God's Son, has won everything God promised to mankind. He is already reigning as man, and glory and honor is his, and everything is subject to him. But then, secondly, we've got God's salvation that he accomplished. I deliberately broke off in the middle of a sentence in verse 9. We see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels, crowned with glory and honor. You have to look up. You have to see Jesus, the man, in our humanity, at God's right hand, with all of the glory and the honor as his. But why was he made lower than the angels? How did he gain that crown of glory and honor for man and as man? Well, he carries on, because of the sufferings of death, so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. Glory and honor is his because of the suffering of death that he went through for everyone else. The one for the many, the one for you, for me, for everyone who's trusting in him as Lord and Saviour. He actually did that for you. He humbled himself. He took our humanity expressly so that he might suffer death in the most terrible form. Angels couldn't do that for you. God, as God is, couldn't do that for you. The Son of God had to become one with us in order that he might do that. And the death was terrifying. I don't just mean crucifixion. He bore the curse of God. He was forsaken by God. He experienced in our place God's wrath and anger for our sin and rebellion. Some people will put their fingers in their ears at this point and say, that's just disgusting. That's hideous. I don't want to hear about a God who would do that to anyone, let alone to his Son. What sort of God is he? Well, let me tell you what sort of God he is. It says here, by the grace of God, he did this. He is a God of grace. And instead of giving you what you deserved and crushing and destroying you for all that you've done to him, he so loves you that he made a plan with his Son and with his Spirit, that because you are so precious to him, he would not give you up, but he would give up the Son that he loves to come and suffer and die for you. So that what he promised and planned at the beginning, you could be with him in his family, enjoying and reigning over his creation. Isn't that lovely? And amazingly, the Son says, I love these people so much. Let me go to the cross for them. Let me give up my rights. Let me give up my comfort. Let me give up my glory and my reputation, my honor and my life, so that I, Father, can bring many sons and daughters home to glory. And the Spirit says, let me go and fly into the world and touch their hearts and open their eyes, that they might put their trust in the one through whom many sons and daughters are brought to glory. Does that sound like a tyrannical God? It sounds like a God of grace to me. I'm not indignant before such a gospel or offended by such a God. I'm simply overwhelmed and amazed at such love and grace lavished upon me. And I look at this and think, Father, it cost you so much. Was there no other way? Look at verse 10. It was fitting. But he, now this is the Father, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. Fitting means it was necessary. It was absolutely essential if he was to bring people home to glory, that he had to do this. The only other way was not to bring you to glory, to let Satan win, to leave you who he created to be with him and to enjoy him forever, to leave you lost and abandoned and alienated from him. A God who doesn't care might do that. A God who broke his promises might do that. But not your God. Not a God of grace. And so he sent his son to be the founder of their salvation. We were looking at this expression a few months ago, and I was telling you that I think that every version of the Bible that I've had since my youth, the translators have struggled for the word here. I grew up on the Authorized Version, and I had a good word here. It was the captain of our salvation. And I was given as a Sunday school prize the New American Standard Version. It was very good. But at this point, it had the author of our salvation, which wasn't quite as exciting to a little boy as captain. Authors were down there. Captains were up here. Then the NIV came out, another very good word. It was the pioneer of our salvation. And then the ESV came out, which I think is the best English version of the Bible that we've got. And yet this word was the weakest of all the words. It was the founder of our salvation. And we said, you won't remember this, Chaz will, because I can remember talking to him about this. Now, if we did a version of the New Testament in English, we would have the trailblazer of our salvation. It's the one who goes on ahead and leads the way and then pulls everybody up to where he's got to. Author makes me think of Charles Dickens with a quill pen sat at his desk. But trailblazing captain. That makes me think of the Normandy beaches and a company of soldiers that are pinned down by enemy fire on the beach, and the trailblazing captain says, "Leave it to me." And he's like Sylvester Stallone always, isn't he? And he takes a hand grenade in each hand, and he crawls under the barbed wire and through the sand, and the sand is coming up on all sides as the enemy are firing at him, but he ploughs on until he gets closer and he launches both the hand grenades into the bunker, and the enemy's obliterated, and he turns round and he says to his company, "Come on up." The trail blazing captain. Well, God gave you a trailblazing captain to bring you to glory. But it says in this verse, he had to be a perfect trailblazing captain. You're thinking perfect means obviously without sin, doesn't it? Well, it will mean that, and that will be very important as we go on into Hebrews. The priest and the sacrifice, which is he is, had to be sinless, but it doesn't mean that at this point. Perfect means complete. And the only way that he could be a perfect, complete, trailblazing captain to save his people was, the end of the verse, through the suffering of death. A death that pays for all your sins, wipes them out, so you can be brought home to glory. A death that silences Satan's accusations so that he can't bring a charge against you. A death through which he tramples on death as he smashes its hold and he reaches into the heart of it and rips the heart out of death in his resurrection. And we can sing, "Oh, trampled death, where is your sting? The angels roar for Christ, the king. Now, this trailblazing captain calls to his struggling brothers and sisters, and he says, I've cleared the way. In fact, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. There's no other way. Don't neglect such a great salvation. Don't go thinking there's another way. Today, look to Jesus and trust him if you've never trusted him before. And if you do trust Jesus, then go on looking to Jesus. We see Jesus, our brother, crowned with glory and honor, who has everything in subjection under his feet, everything under his control. Not just the big events of this age, which is passing away, but the providences of your life as well, because you're a son, a daughter, whom he is bringing through all of those storms home to glory. I know that some of you are going through great storms at the moment. And all I can do is say what the writer to the Hebrews would have said. Look to Jesus, who is greater than the storms. Look to him whose sovereign power is unrivaled and absolute, yet whose love for you took him to the loneliness and the darkness of the cross. And if he loved you so much then, he loves you the same today, because he is Jesus, the same yesterday and today and forever. You can trust him. And he's not ashamed to call you brother, sister. I'm going to close by reading the last hymn, which is a cue to the musicians to take their posts. And I wanted to read right through it because you'll see how many of the themes in our last hymn are woven in, or taken rather, from Hebrews chapter 2. We're going to sing this hymn, but let's just enjoy the words. Come, behold the wondrous mystery in the dawning of the King. He, the theme of heaven's praises, robed in frail humanity, in our longing, in our darkness. Now the light of life has come. Look to Christ, who condescended, took on flesh to ransom us. Come behold the wondrous mystery. He, the perfect Son of Man, in his living, in his suffering, never trace nor stain of sin. See the true, the better Adam. Come to save the hell-bound man. Christ, the great and sure fulfillment of the law. In him we stand. Come behold the wondrous mystery. Christ, the Lord upon the tree. In the stead of ruined sinners hangs the Lamb in victory. See the price of our redemption. See the Father's plan unfold, bringing many sons to glory. You can say daughters as well. Grace unmeasured, love untold. Come behold the wondrous mystery. Slain by death, the God of life, but no grave could e'er restrain him. Praise the Lord. He is alive. What a foretaste of deliverance. How unwavering our hope. Christ in power, resurrected, as we will be when he comes. Look to Jesus and understand that all he is has been done for you. What he's done has been done for you. And as he is, you will be crowned with glory and honor.